You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Pariahs in Paradise by Emily Jane Fox. At many restaurants, owners and servers pat Kushner on the back, a thank you to the Trump administration, pushing to reopen businesses during the pandemic. After one Affinity staff party, which Kushner hosted at a kosher restaurant near their office, the owner picked up the tab. Kushner left a tip that was big enough to cover the tab, and then some. It's more peaceful than he could have imagined, Kushner tells friends. Less flashy, more fulfilling is how he puts it. At the beginning of the year, he set four priorities for 2022: family, religion, health, and work. Trump, for her part, has taken more time to settle. Until recently, she mostly stayed mum on social media, apart from photos and videos of her in Poland with Ukrainian refugees or handing out aid after natural disasters. As she found her footing and her friend group, the post got more frequent. Boating trips with new mom friends, family travel photos, a handful of images from her sister Tiffany's wedding at Mar-a-Lago, at which she was a matron of honor. She has taken up surfing and wakeboarding and is learning breathing techniques. She wears a little red Kabbalah bracelet on her wrist. So does he. They're spending more time as hands-on parents, certainly, and more time as a couple, as they face the unexpected death of Trump's mother, Ivana, over the summer, and Kushner's bout with thyroid cancer, which he first dealt with quietly while they were in Washington, and again in the summer, when the two traveled to Minnesota to the Mayo Clinic, where he underwent a second surgery. By all accounts, they are a true partnership. When his book launched, Trump posted about it more than Kushner, blasting emails to her father's fundraising list and posting to her 7.5 million Instagram followers. Kushner joined her this fall to accept a posthumous First Grade Medal of Merit on behalf of her mother from Czech Republic President Miloš Zeman. Jared played Instagram husband, snapping photos of her at the event and around Prague. An art, he tells people, he has mastered over the years. It is both spin and sin to speak of Miami and New York, of Floridians and New Yorkers, as equals. John Updike knew this when he said that people living anywhere else were, in some sense, kidding. I venture a guess Updike would agree that anyone choosing to live in Miami over New York is all but dead. Again, though, Kushner could be the exception. Life is better for him in Florida. He's richer than ever. He's raised his money and sold his book there. He's found his people, who, if they don't peacock full MAGA, at least seem to be comfortable enough with the association. He believes that meetings in Miami are better than they were in New York, that at this point, everyone he could want to meet passes through Miami and comes to do business in a way that they don't do anywhere else. He still waxes romantic about the time in New York before all of this, in the city of his 20s and early 30s, that was ruled by the likes of Mike Bloomberg and Graydon Carter, Ron Perelman and Peter Kaplan. That version of the city, he tells people, is over. Now he and his new friends have the opportunity to do the same for Miami, a city waiting to be rebuilt, and a group of people like him ready to imagine its future. It's a soft power he is exercising behind the scenes. This year, he brokered a meeting between Suarez, the president of the Miami Dolphins, and FIFA president Gianni Infantino to negotiate bringing one of the 2026 World Cup games to Miami. They walked away with a game set. The room was full when Kushner took the stage in a conference room filled with palm trees and upholstered swivel chairs in Riyadh at the end of October, For the sixth annual three-day Future Investment Initiative gathering, nicknamed Davos of the Desert. It's the same Saudi royal-run conference that just a few years earlier, just about every leader in both the private and public sectors boycotted because of Khashoggi's murder. And this year was still not attended by any member of the Biden administration. American investors turned up in force regardless. Jamie Dimon and David Solomon, the CEOs of J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, took the stage on the first day, as did Ray Dalio and Stephen Schwarzman. Kushner's former White House colleagues, Steve Mnuchin and Anthony Scaramucci, were also on the schedule. Kushner was on stage alongside former Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in a discussion about peace and prosperity. It was not unlike the sorts of panels that Trump sometimes sat on in her White House years. In the early days of the Trump administration, she'd flown to Berlin in order to take questions alongside German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Queen Maxima of the Netherlands, and Christine Lagarde, then head of the International Monetary Fund. In those days, whenever I ask anyone who really knew her if she would one day run for office, the response was probably no. The goal was to be someone on that sort of stage, but without the election. She had been the shiny star, the vastly more famous and poised one in their union, the one on her way, wherever that may take her. That was her stage. As Kushner prepared to step into the spotlight before an audience of the richest, most connected, most powerful people in the world, Trump was capping off a three-hour dinner of her own at the Beverly Hills Hotel. The company, her friend, Kim Kardashian. power cords. After a turbulent year for her famous family, Willow Smith pours her anger and vulnerability into a surprising new rock album by Chris Murphy, with photos by Adrian Raquel, styled by Ronnie Hart. Opening photo, Songbird, Willow Smith photographed in Los Angeles on November 8, 2022, and other photos of her wearing high-fashion outfits. Willow Smith's scream is a fearsome thing, a visceral, guttural wail you'd expect from a 90s metal band. You can hear it all over her new album, Coping Mechanism, and it comes as a surprise from an artist who recently went TikTok viral with her neo-soul psychedelic R&B track, Wait a Minute. It's also at odds with a 22-year-old person sitting across from me on Zoom who's wearing a fuzzy jacket and gray hoodie atop her shaved head and feeding her rescue dog, Corn, a bone, while waxing poetic about the intrinsic beauty of the universe. Nowadays, I've just been looking at the world and being like, wow, Willow says, the unknown energy that makes the ocean do its thing, that makes stars explode, that allows black holes and other cosmos to exist. It's a beautiful thing. Even though life has a lot of suffering, and even though there's a lot of pain, there's also a lot of beauty. Willow is the only daughter of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith, the sister of rapper and actor Jaden Smith, and an artist in her own right, since her earwormy pop rap jam, Whip My Hair, went to number 11 on the charts just a few days after her 10th birthday. What, you may wonder, could Willow have to scream about? Oh man, she says with a heavy sigh, being born. She leads me on a thought experiment about just that, outlining the shocks and pressures that follow most humans on their journey from womb to tomb, beginning with that first moment that someone slaps you on the ass. Society, she says, doesn't want you to grow into the most realized, unique version of yourself. Willow is not asking for special dispensation or suggesting that her own passage has been existentially harder than yours. Life is not easy for anyone. We all have our own stuff. On Coping Mechanism, she's not screaming for herself, but for all of us. It's not really about where I come from, she says. It's more about just the existential trauma of being alive in general. For Willow, that trauma has manifested itself in a lifelong struggle with anxiety. It's so central to her being that she formed a band called The Anxiety with musician Tyler Cole in 2019. Coincidentally, or maybe prophetically, they dropped their debut self-titled album on March 13, 2020, the day the country's blood pressure skyrocketed because of COVID. 2.5 years later, she's in a completely different space creatively and rethinking the disorder. Sometimes we need to sit there and be like, loneliness, okay, I see you. Anxiety, okay, I see you, she says. Now, she tells me, she knows that those specters don't speak to the totality of who she is. I think in the past, I made the mistake of identifying too much with, oh, I am an anxious person. Those are just passing phases. Turning difficult emotions into art is something of a family business. Willow co-hosts the hit Facebook Live show Red Table Talk, where three generations of Smith women, including Jada and Jada's mother, Adrienne Banfield Norris, affectionately referred to as Gammy, bring guests as varied as Jeanette McCurdy, August Alsina, and Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, to have soul-bearing conversations. It was there, in a supportive environment, with her mother and grandmother, that Willow shared that she is polyamorous. I love people, and the one thing that I want to do with the platform that I have is love people harder and harder every day, she says of Red Table Talk. I feel like being vulnerable is one of the first steps to opening your heart to people and letting them know that they can be vulnerable too, because being vulnerable is power, I think. Willow's family very publicly plumbed new depths of vulnerability after her father slapped Chris Rock, because the comedian made a joke at her mother's expense during the Oscars. How did they survive that difficult time? Like I said, I love people, Willow says carefully. Me and my family, we are a tight-knitted group of people, and I love them. I couldn't be more grateful and more honored to share that with them. You can sense Willow's devotion to her family, even in her music. Her foray into rock feels like a direct homage to Jada, who has fronted the new metal band Wicked Wisdom. I would say that every woman of color who has picked up a guitar, or picked up the drums, or picked up the bass, or started to sing, or wanted to express herself through this genre of music is in a beautiful lineage, Willow says. We've been silenced for a long time, and that's ending. Sometimes you need to scream to be heard. The Montreal Mafia Murders. When an unwitting rural Canadian couple met two local mob henchmen, Coen Brothers level mayhem ensued. But the gory murders they became party to were anything but a joke. By Adam Leith Goldner. Illustrations by Nicole Rifkin. Opening illustration shows a montage of winding wooded roads, fast cars, blood, guns, and flashing eyes in fear. On the morning they were arrested for allegedly burning bodies as part of a series of mafia murders, Marie Josevio and Gideon had already finished breakfast and packed their daughter off to elementary school. A hand-drawn Mother's Day card hung on the fridge next to family photographs. Vio, 44, didn't have to go to her shift at the roadside poutine restaurant until later that day, so she tried baking something new, blueberry phyllo puffs. The pastries were still on the stovetop when police arrived at 9:56 a.m. on October 16, 2019. "We're normal people," Vio swore to the arresting officers through her tears, after she and her husband were each charged with two counts of first-degree murder. "We didn't kill anyone." Undercover recordings made by investigators told a different tale. The Interception Division of the Sûreté du Québec had secretly taped Vio and Dion speaking about how they disposed of bodies for members of the Calabrian Mafia. By their own admission, they'd incinerated corpses in their yard in a bonfire. "We did what we could with what we had," she explained when police questioned her about the cremations. "But setting the bodies on fire?" a sergeant detective asked. "Was that idea from Guy, as he's a fireman?" Guy Dion was the tall, burly, 48-year-old fire chief of their small Quebec township. To make ends meet, he moonlighted for a paving company and refereed minor league hockey games. His wife, Vio, worked as a cook and cashier at a fast food chain called La Belle Provence. Yearning for a way out of that dead-end job, she'd been taking online courses in business administration and freelancing as a building inspector. She had a hard face with sharp eyes and hair as long, dark, and wild as Dion's was short, thin, and graying. The two lived in the countryside beyond Montreal, in the farming community of Saint-Jude, population 1,326, a village named after the patron saint of desperate cases. That's precisely the higher power the couple needed when a dozen law enforcement vehicles converged on the property. Before being taken away in an unmarked cruiser, a visibly shaking Vio requested a moment to switch outfits. She also wanted to know what would happen to their daughter when she got home from school. Officers informed her that child care procedures were already underway. Outside the front window, the fall foliage had started changing color. The couple's lawn, shrouded in dead leaves, was cordoned off with police tape. One maple tree stood out from the others, so red and orange that it seemed covered in flames. The mayor of Saint-Jude told reporters that he fell off his chair when he learned that two seemingly upstanding locals had been accused of such nightmarish undertakings. "It shows you really know people. It shows you never really know people you think you know." Like real-life characters from Fargo, Vio and Dion had gotten all mixed up with killers for hire. What prosecutors wanted to know was, were the husband and wife merely rubes who'd been duped into participating in the gruesome homicides, or had they cooperated knowingly and willingly? Seeking teeth, bone fragments, and other traces of the victims, investigators started combing through their yard, their garage, and the quiet stream across the street. The murder cycle. 3.5 years earlier, on May 27, 2016, Rocco Sas Solicito got into his BMW for the very last time. The 67-year-old director of operations for Montreal Sicilian Mafia drove through the parking lot of his luxury condo complex, wads of hundreds bulging in his pockets. The chopard on his wrist caught the morning light, showing exactly 8:30. From across the street, a lookout on a motorcycle tracked the BMW. His helmet's dark visor shielded his face. When he saw Consigliere Solicito steering onto the boulevard, the man on the speed bike raced ahead, cueing other members of his crew to get into position. A black Acura then sliced in front of the BMW. At the next stop sign, the Acura braked to a full halt, blocking the way for several seconds. Long enough for Solicito to notice a man with a motorcycle helmet at the bus shelter to his right. The man pulled out a 9mm Taurus handgun. Solicito didn't try to escape. He didn't ram the Acura. He simply watched as the man approached and began firing through the passenger side window. "I emptied the loading clip into him," the gunman later recounted. "He ate it all." One of the 9 hollow point bullets ripped Solicito's heart apart, killing him. The Acura veered off, while the assassin fled around the corner to join the motorcyclist who'd sped by a minute earlier. He jumped onto the bike's back seat, and the two men headed into the crisp spring air. By the time police and paramedics arrived, the culprits had evaporated. "It's not complicated. It's a mob hit," a police spokesperson said in the aftermath. "It was clinical. No DNA. No usable clues." But Solicito was a highly symbolic casualty in the war between Montreal's Sicilian mafiosi and their Calabrian counterparts. The Calis, as the city's Calabrese crooks call themselves, were suddenly poised to seize control of a vast underworld operation connected to New York, Latin America, and the Old Country. Whoever killed Solicito would be sure to gain the respect of 'Ndrangheta, the most extensive and powerful criminal organization in the world, as Interpol calls the group. 'Ndrangheta, based in Calabria, operates in dozens of countries and generates $50 billion per year. Its chief stronghold outside Italy is Canada, where Ontario's Camera di Controllo makes decisions affecting an entire global network. Montreal, however, had long eluded 'Ndrangheta's grasp. According to Italy's anti-mafia brigade, for decades, Montreal has been the key that turns the lock of America. Since 1980 or so, the kingpins with the keys had been the Stitches, as the city's Sicilian faction is known. Before then, going back to the era of Lucky Luciano and the so-called French Connection, Calabrians ran the books. But in the late 1970s, they'd been forced to hand things over after a blood feud with the Stitches. And wiping out Solicito was part of a vendetta intended to reverse that defeat. As Solicito's murderer would later explain, the goal of the Calabrians was to get rid of all the Sicilians, take the power, and prevent them from getting back on their feet. That hitman's name has been under a court-ordered publication ban since he became an informant and entered witness protection in 2019. His street name, though, the Frenchman, refers to the fact that, despite working for the mob, he isn't Sicilian or Calabrian. He's a weed-blazing Quebecer. The Frenchman's undercover recordings have shed lurid light on the mafia's worldwide narco-trafficking networks, revealing battles between clan members stretching from the hilltops of southern Italy and drug production regions to cities across North America, even to rural homes like Vio and Dion's. For this story, Vanity Fair was granted access to those shocking audio files, portions of which are reproduced verbatim. The evidence collected by the Frenchman and touted as a major breakthrough by the Canadian justice system, as well as courtroom testimony and investigators' tape recordings, have so far resulted in 2 life sentences, with more trials to come. Alongside Vio and Dion, the other star defendant has been the alleged motorcycle driver from the Solicito escapade, a 41-year-old capo for the Calis who dated Vio's younger sister during the crime war. The Frenchman describes him as the big cockroach. That capo's name has also been under publication ban, So for the purposes of this story, he will be called Foti. But court documents and local French language media have referred to him by the alias that he gave when he signed up for a burner phone right before Solicito's death, Brad Pitt. The menu. Foti and the Frenchman bolted away from the blood-soaked BMW on the motorbike. Cop cars, meanwhile, barreled past them toward the crime scene. Looking up, the two riders spotted helicopters in the sky. They braced against the wind, certain they'd get caught, but no one stopped them. Earlier that morning, in fact, the duo had a close call with police at a garage in the suburbs north of Montreal. Around 5 a.m., as they'd been preparing for the hit at their stash house, they were picking out guns, toys, as they called them. Foti started posing with a piece like De Niro in a Scorsese film. "Don't do that," the Frenchman growled, as Foti pulled the slide and aimed at some imaginary target. Losing patience, the Frenchman told him again to stop playing around. At that moment, the gun accidentally went off, and a bullet blasted into the wall. "Idiot," the Frenchman seethed, opening the garage door. They rolled out the motorcycle and revved the engine. Just then, a patrol car coasted by, windows open. It slowed so that the two cops could look them over in the dawn light. The hitmen stood there in the driveway, trying to act normal. Gunfire at that bleary hour in a quiet residential neighborhood? No matter. Seemingly satisfied that the sound had conceivably been a motorbike backfiring, the officers went on their way. According to prosecutors, Foti was at that point a getaway man. His cohorts saw him as calculating, with commendable skills in manipulation and flattery. But he tended to be shaky in stressful situations. Yes, Foti claimed he'd previously killed someone on the street. And yet his higher-ups wanted him to make his bones, to be the gunman in a premeditated hit. Once he did so, he'd be promoted to capo. He'd been psyching himself up when the toy went off. He spoke with a bro-inflected North Shore accent, punctuating his comments with cusses like menage, damn, or menotia, male sex organ. The Frenchman, on the other hand, swore in Quebecois blasphemies, tabernacle, an expletive that literally means tabernacle, but serves as the equivalent of the F-word. He consumed steroids and stupendous amounts of marijuana, often 2 ounces or more per day. Despite living with myriad conditions, bipolar 2, severe attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, borderline personality disorder, his mind could focus under pressure. Diagnosed with an antisocial personality marked by narcissistic grandiosity and paranoia, he saw himself, as he would state, in one tape-recorded conversation as a chess player and not a lobotomized partridge. He talked ridiculously fast. Foti, too, was a motor mouth. Together, their lingo was full of references, both filmic and gnomic. To them, a contracted killing, such as Solicito's, was codenamed a cannoli, in homage to a now-classic scene from The Godfather. To assassinate someone was to eat them or pepper them. A hired gun pulling the trigger was a squeezer. The list of foes to be drilled with specific price tags on their heads was the menu. When we do a hit, we say we're going to go eat, go to the restaurant, testified the Frenchman. That's what the menu was for us. Menus were shared among the gang via encrypted devices called boxes, usually BlackBerry pagers. These to-do lists came from the table, composed of senior mafia members. The job that morning had been advertised as a $300,000 meal, but collecting payment for cannolis isn't simple, as Foti and the Frenchman were about to learn. The farmhouse. After ditching the bike in the stash house garage, the two drove Foti's car to Vieux and Dion's backwoods home in Saint-Jude, an hour away. The mobsters went there to wash up, lose the murder weapon, and burn their clothes. The couple in the woods had only gotten to know Foti recently, but he was already luring them into his web. They met through Vio's two younger siblings. Her brother, Martin Vio, had been in jail with Foti and the Frenchman. Conspiracy, gangsterism, and drug trafficking for Foti, aggravated assault for the Frenchman. Foti was looking for a woman on the outside, someone who could help him start over. Martin suggested to his sister, Stephanie Vio, that she might make a good match for Foti. Stephanie began visiting him in the slammer. When he got out, they dated and moved in together in the late summer or early fall of 2015. The couple spent time hanging out with Vio and Dion. They talked, dined, enjoyed each other's company. Foti soon made his move. He asked them if he could borrow $10,000, offering to pay back $1,000 a month plus $1,000 for interest. "This doesn't smell good," Vio told her husband. Despite their apprehensions, they loaned Foti the funds in February 2016. The bad smell soon turned fetid. Next illustration, dupes or duplicitous. Gideon and Marie-José Vio were alleged to have incinerated corpses in their yard at the mob's urging. At the outset, Foti paid the monthly $1,000. He stopped doing so by May, the month of Solicito's murder. He then altered the deal's terms. He would give them an extra $1,000 a month to store tools in the crawl space above their sprawling garage. Those tools ended up being hockey bags full of pistols, submachine guns, explosives, and ammo. Foti got them a dedicated BlackBerry pager. His contact name in the device was Bag of Nails. The arsenal in the garage soon became so extensive that when Vio prepared an inventory, it ran to 36 pages. "I could have gone to war with that man," she marveled. They could have also tried to back out many times. But incredibly, as Vio explained in the undercover recordings, she harbored aspirations of being part of this outlaw life, of actually joining the mafia in some capacity. Torn between trepidation and excitement, she'd imagined an escape from a lifetime of drudgery. "I want to be around the table," she confided to the Frenchman, bringing up her Italian heritage. "I was raised that way by my grandmother, with Fantaloni's and Garalusi's. My family had honor. I want that honor to be reestablished." On the day of Solicito's murder, Dion wasn't home. But as Vio originally told police, and as the Frenchman testified in court, she was there and assisted the killers, building a fire in a metal canister on her lawn. The two men burned their outfits, including shoes and helmets. Foti then jumped into the above-ground pool while the Frenchman showered, rinsing off any gunshot residue. After changing into fresh clothing, they promised her they'd return soon to sell some of the contents of the hockey bags. When news of the murder broke on TV, the two men high-fived. It was time to get paid. Splitting the pie, Salvatore Scopa greeted Foti with a tight hug. "More to come," he bellowed, laughing, as he always did when his henchmen killed someone. A hulking musclehead, known to his cronies as Mental, Sal Scopa was big in the Calabrian mob. His brother Andrew Scopa would soon be considered by law enforcement as the presumed acting boss of the Montreal Mafia. It was Sal, however, who'd ordered that morning's cannoli on Rocco Solicito, and he congratulated Foti and the Frenchman. They were gathered at Piatti, a marble-strewn pizza pasta spot near the intersection where Solicito had been slain hours earlier. Also at the table was the Acura driver, a quiet, skinny Calabrian squeezer nicknamed Sigmund. He lived with his mother. In the lead-up to the crime, the group had contemplated dressing up as postman or pretending to direct traffic. But the Frenchman had vetoed those scenarios. We don't do no cowboy stuff. Appiatti, Scopa, pleased with the result, told them he had an offer to make. They could either split $100,000 in cash, or they could take $50,000 and 10% of his territory. That turf was worth $2 million in annual drug sales and pizzo, protection money. The Frenchmen couldn't believe it, contending they'd been promised much more for the job. "You're an effing pig," he snarled, standing up at the table and reaching for a steak knife. "It was supposed to be $300K plus 10% for killing Rocco."
"Shh,"
replied Scopa, as the others tried to get the manic Frenchman to sit back down. The Frenchman was losing it, spiraling. He'd thought that peppering Solicito would provide a rush of release. Instead, he could feel the whole deal slipping from his grasp. Scopa, he believed, was stiffing the gang, plain and simple. In the Frenchman's courtroom accounts of that moment, everything became a blur, a Hitchcockian dream sequence, violin stabs and all. By sheer cosmic coincidence, another wise guy in the stitches, Tony the florist, whose name was on the Calabrian's menu for an upcoming cannoli, just happened to be seated across the room. The Frenchman, known for habitually smoking too much hashish, lost his focus. He pivoted his attention toward Tony the florist and the purported $150,000 bounty on his head. The Frenchman started talking about getting a gun. "I killed one person today," he ranted, "and I'm going to kill another right now. I don't give an F." He was ready, then and there, to plant geraniums in the florist cranium. As the Frenchman would tell the tale in court, it seemed like an act, as though he were in some kind of stage troupe, putting on a Polly Walnuts-like performance. Echoing tropes from the gangland movies they loved, the others reminded him, in whispers, that even if he did pluck the florist petals, he'd have to share the $150,000 with them. As accomplices, they'd all be eating from the pie. "Italians are the masters of betrayal," piped up Sigmund, the Acura driver. "Treachery, it's the DNA." Stitches and snitches. Sal and Andrew Scopa, both of Calabrian extraction, came up in Montreal's Sicilian mob under Godfather Vito Rizzuto, whose decades-long reign ended when he passed away in 2013, evidently of natural causes. Rizzuto had hailed from the Cosa Nostra hotbed of Sicily's Agrigento province. He led Montreal's organization known as the Stitches, or the Sixth Family, due to its interconnectedness with New York's Five Families. Italian court documents depicted Rizzuto as a global superboss who created a transnational society linking Italian clans with overseas cells. Clandestine recordings of mafiosi in Palermo captured discussions of how Rizzuto in Montreal makes the effing rules. An associate in Sicily conveying his proximity to Rizzuto was recorded as saying, "I sit at the right hand of God." Rizzuto used humbler terms. "People come to me to solve disputes," he told one Quebec journalist. Able to broker peace between rivals, he saw himself as a mediator. In reality, he was a dapper underworld diplomat whose conflict resolution skills had far-reaching consequences. In 2005, when a $6 billion suspension bridge connecting Sicily to Calabria was set to be built, Italy's Direzione Investigativa Antimafia revealed that the consortium bidding to finance the construction was covertly being overseen by Rizzuto. The bridge was never built, nor was his Italian arrest warrant enforced, as he would soon be extradited to the U.S. for participating in the 1981 murders of three Bonanno family captains. During the 6 years he spent in a Colorado supermax prison, numerous members of his circle, including his father and his eldest son, were killed. The The Scopa brothers remained loyal to the Rizzuto family throughout Vito's imprisonment. And shortly before his release in 2012, the New York Post reported that Rizzuto's stated aim was to be godfather of the world. Upon returning home, the Don conferred with Andrew Scopa, who hoped to become his right-hand man, according to a recent book, Inside the Montreal Mafia, by Eric Thibault and Félix Séguin. But the Stitches decided on a new management structure, with Rocco Solicito's son and one of Vito Rizzuto's sons at the top. Andrew was out. Andrew's brother Sal stayed on as one of the Stitches' squeezers. His signature move, the Frenchman testified, was to submerge foes in a bathtub full of acid and watch them melt. In the summer of 2015, the Sicilian table decided that Sal, however, had become a snitch and had to be liquidated. When Sal found out, he vowed revenge, with Foti as his operations guy. Their first hit came in September 2015, when they killed an up-and-coming member of the Stitches. 6 weeks later, before the Solicito Rizzutos could respond, their leaders were arrested in a crackdown. Police wanted anyone tempted to take their place to know they were being monitored. The Scopa brothers didn't care. They were a new Nadrina, as Calabrians call a blood-related unit that rises to take over a city, and they had declared war. A love triangle and some hockey bags. Vio and Dion, meanwhile, were getting on with their lives in Saint-Jude, and Foti was increasingly becoming part of the decor, as Vio put it. Foti would come over for occasional dinners. One time, they all attended a tractor-pulling event somewhere in the sticks. Another time, Foti showed up in a panic because he'd somehow messed up and angered his bosses in the Calabria mob. Dion kept up his firefighting job while taking on occasional asphalting projects. He was a steady-state, steak-and-potatoes homebody, happiest when doing repairs around their 100-year-old house or tooling around on his ATV. At one point, Foti arranged for Dion to be Sal Scopa's bodyguard at the boss's son's baptism, a $500 gig. Then came the ill-fated $10,000 loan, which was steep for Vio and Dion. When they'd purchased their $7,000 hot tub, they'd had to save up for 18 months in order to afford it. Vio, despite a degree in civil engineering, couldn't manage to land a skilled position. Instead, she was resigned to working night shifts at the restaurant, finishing at 7 a.m. before driving an hour back to Saint-Jude. She'd considered opening a bar, but that fell through. When Foti met her, she'd been constantly questioning herself over her lack of options. "What am I doing?" she asked her husband at one point, wondering if she was having a midlife crisis at 41. She felt like a pawn, which is exactly how the Callies would end up using her. Next illustration, the killer returns. After 3 years of silence, the Frenchman shockingly reappeared at Vio's out-of-the-way restaurant. It's impossible to say with certainty how much she understood of Foti's world, but mafia books were found in her possession, so she obviously knew she was flirting with fire. As her younger sister Stephanie, Foti's girlfriend, reminded her, if you want to play in the big leagues, there are consequences. Marie-José brushed those concerns aside. At that point, the Frenchman was still in prison. When he came up for parole, an evaluation deemed him a significant risk for recidivism. The authorities recommended he be kept under observance at a halfway house. The day before his transfer, two fellow inmates jumped him. Badly beaten, he showed up to the transitional home with stitches on his face. The probation agent assigned to his case turned out to be an attractive 22-year-old officer called Noemi. Under Canadian law, her real name can't be published. She comes to bring me my clothes, my box, and she stares me down right in the face, he testified. She bends down without even leaving my eyes, so I say, uh-oh, trouble. Noemi's duties included physically escorting him outside the grounds on errands like shopping for groceries. The two soon began seeing each other discreetly. He'd only had one serious girlfriend before, whereas Noemi, so he claimed, was a hypersexual swinger. Their relationship continued until another detainee, who happened to be the same height and build, was gunned down outside the home. The Frenchman had been the target as retribution for a crooked deal involving the Sinaloa cartel, but they'd sprayed the wrong guy. In the ensuing investigation, when police discovered the Frenchman had been sleeping with his intervention officer, his parole was revoked. Locked up again, he asked Noemi to collect money owed to him by Foti. She did, and Noemi and Foti then apparently started an affair without the Frenchman knowing. When the Frenchman finally got out for good in April 2016, he moved in with Noemi. At that time, Foti introduced the Frenchman to Sal Scopa, suggesting he be the boss's driver and bodyguard, his salami in their parlance. The Frenchman said he'd do whatever Scopa wanted. "I'll be loyal to you like a Taliban to his faith," he told him. "To the end, I'm all in." He became a squeezer. And after they terminated Solicito, Scopa told Foti it was time that he, too, became a proper hitter. If he did a good job, Scopa promised, he'd make Foti his underboss, his capo. The list of people the Scopas wanted dead was long. It included figures like Lieutenant Lorenzo the Skunk Girano and others in the stitches. "The Calabresi want to clean them all out," the Frenchman explained under oath. "In the type of jungle they're in, you eat them all or you eat nothing." Next up on the menu were two brothers in their 20s, Joey and Vinny Falduto. Vinny had just gotten out of jail, and according to Calabrian intel, was a hitman working for the Sicilians. The brothers were reputedly pursuing a crook known as Fatso, with a $400,000 sticker on his forehead. Since both the Callies and the Stitches wanted Fatso dead, Foti offered to help the Faldutos do the job as a means of trapping them. The idea was to bring the brothers to Vio and Dion's farmhouse to sample the goods in the hockey bags and then whack them both. Vio and Dion supposedly knew nothing about the whacking. All they'd been told, they would later claim, was that prospective buyers for the gun stash were coming over to fire off test rounds before agreeing on a deal for the merchandise. The couple had been instructed to make a racket so that neighbors wouldn't hear any gunfire. On that day, in mid-June 2016, Vio had music blasting. Dion was on his tractor. First, the Faldutos perused the cash. Glocks, .357 Magnums, .22-caliber rifles. They then went outside and started shooting into the ground next to the garage, which was Foti's signal to do the deed. Instead, he seized up. The Frenchman glared at him, but Foti couldn't go through with it. After some awkward talk, Foti decided to lend them his car so they'd have a pretext for seeing each other again. The Faldutos also took a Mac-10 with a silencer, a sausage, they called it, for Fatso. Make the bodies disappear. 2 weeks later, on June 30th, 2016, the Faldutos returned to Saint-Jude. The couple, as agreed, was making the usual din. The day before, according to the body pack recordings, Vio had brought Foti 4 boxes of hollow point bullets from the hockey bags. The Frenchman relished hollow points, which flare open on impact. "They mushroom," he noted. "They don't pass through the body, they stay in." When the two cars pulled into the driveway of the country home, the radio was outside, hanging from a tree, its volume knob cranked to the max. The tractor was running in the background, and Dion was cutting down trees with a chainsaw. "It's like a B-movie," the Frenchman would recall. The Faldutos entered the three-door garage. Vio watched through her front window. Walking in, the Frenchman looked pointedly at Foti. Let's do this. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.